The views expressed on Skeptically Speaking do not necessarily reflect the opinions of the University of Alberta, the Students' Union, or CJSR.
Like the awkwardness of running into an old friend from school and not being able to remember their name, you are now Skeptically Speaking, the brand new show that challenges you to call in and question everything, including whatever happened to that little program called Q Transmissions? Skeptically Speaking is hosted by that girl from school you could never forget. Take it away, Dez.
Thanks, Sean. You are listening to Skeptically Speaking. So, since it's the first day, we're going to be... We're going to take it easy. Some of the ads might be maybe not quite so clear. We might have some technical difficulties. Please do bear with us. So today we're going to be talking about secularism in Alberta. But first, a brief explanation for anybody who did miss last week's show. After Heather's sudden departure... and her foray into the world of Islamic Scientology, I decided we should switch things up a bit. So there's a revamped program format, a new website for anybody who may have seen it already. It's beautiful. It's almost finished. And as you heard, I have a lovely new producer, Sean Ouimet.
Hello.
And you may remember him. He's actually been on the show a few times now. So we're going to start out this week with a bit of news, and the big story is, I hope you all have heard about this, the Canadian Science Minister Gary Goodyear, and his thoughts on evolution, specifically that it's a private matter, not for public consumption. He was questioned about it. Apparently researchers had heard rumors of some kind that he was a creationist. And so when he was questioned directly about it, he said, "I'm not going to answer that question. I am a Christian, and I don't think anybody asking a question about my religion is appropriate." And again, this is the science minister. I also find it interesting because he's also a chiropractor. And on this show, that means something. But as of Wednesday, Mr. Goodyear actually changed his tune, and he said, of course he believes in evolution. He added that he had not answered the question in the newspaper interview because he thought that the matter was irrelevant to his duties as science minister. Before the TV clarification aired, university researchers told CBC News that they worried that someone who controls the purse strings appears to confuse evolution with religion. So this is an interesting juxtaposition between Canada and the U.S., in my opinion, because in the States, money makes people say they're Christians. But in Canada, potential loss of funding forces people to say that they believe in evolution. That means something. I'm not sure what.
Yeah, it's an interesting switch for sure. The fact he was kind of pushed into having to make that statement alone says something, whereas in the States, you definitely would have the hesitation to even want to say you might believe in it. Evolution for risk of alienating half your voters.
I know. For a moment there, I was almost a nationalist. It was neat.
Just so close.
So close. Yeah. So let me see. One of the new format changes is a new segment that we call Speaking Up. We'll have local skeptics and sometimes not so local ones calling in to talk about issues that are interesting or important to them. And for our inaugural, thank you. Speaking Up, we have Edmontonian and fellow skeptic Mike Harrison here in the studio, and he's going to be talking about the psychology of gender. Hello, Mike.
Hello.
What do you got for us?
Well, this is something that's interested me for a long time. It basically started with a sociology class where they were talking about looking for discrete properties of gender and basically like characteristics that you would see universally across genders. And the interesting result of that class was that looking cross-culturally at different groups and different societies over time, they found that there weren't really any roles or characteristics that were uniquely identified with one gender or the other. And this had me interested years ago, and I was doing more research on it online, and I've seen that we've really developed this line of thinking quite a bit. There was an assumption for a while because women's brains are a little bit smaller. It's about in the 10% range. There was, you know, not surprisingly, from old school thinking that was used to justify a whole lot of strange cultural ideas.
You mean sexism?
Yeah, that thing. Okay. Yeah. So that was used to justify a lot of things. That doesn't really have too much relevance to cognitive capability, we figured out, just because, I mean, the brain is a large, complicated, you know, machine. You see computers of various sizes, you know, with hooked up with all kinds of different devices. The size of the computer doesn't necessarily relate to the, you know, the processing power of it. It's really about, you know, the little components that do the, you know, the various bits of processing. So it's not about bulk. And anyway, what I found online about this was that since that time, since we've moved on past that argument, we begin to discover that there are actually some structural and some hormonal differences in between men and women that actually do have a very real impact on the way that men and women process information. It doesn't seem like there's a great deal of quantitative difference in the amount of information that they can go through, or like, say, like language capability or mathematical capability. In fact, there's a lot of studies that study exactly that, and they find that basically the genders are equivalent on most parameters. But it looks like men and women seem to process information completely differently in a lot of cases. In some cases, it's very much the same because, you know, a lot of the brain structures are analogous. But in many cases, like, for example, you've probably heard that men are better at visuospatial tasks and things like rotating objects in 3D space and that kind of stuff, right? So that's true. Basically, the one area of the brain that men use for visuospatial tasks is about 10% larger, and not surprisingly, they do about 10% better on these particular tasks. On other tasks, say like memory or language construction, like basically, you know, language processing, I find that women do better on these ones because of the areas of the brain that they're relying on and the particular processes that they're using basically to put things together. So it seems like even on tasks that seem very elementary, men and women have a completely different neurological way of approaching them a lot of the time.
But is it, my question would be, is it neurological or is it based on environment and sort of a learned behavior?
Well, that's something that they definitely, you know, try and take into consideration. Obviously there's controls for these kinds of things. They take people from different cultural groups and such and, you know, try and minimize those differences as much as they can, or at least account for them. But what they've been doing lately is actually examining the brain using fMRI. So they're basically measuring electrical activity in different parts of the brain.
And fMRI is?
The magnetic resonance imaging. I forget what the F stands for. I'm sure it's not very important.
Okay, move on.
Yeah. Googling is good for that. But basically, they're looking at the electrical activity in the brain as people are performing different tasks, right? And you know, one of the tasks that they were looking at, or one of the you know, stresses that they were looking at, was actually how men and women respond to stress. You know, performance anxiety, anxiety at work, whatever. Men will basically divert a lot of blood into the prefrontal cortex, which is associated with the fight or flight response. If you're familiar with that, basically. Whereas women will pump a lot of blood into the limbic system, which is sort of in the core of the brain. It's associated with the tend or befriend response. And these are catchy little phrases that, you know, are kind of vague. But basically, they get across the idea that there is a pretty large difference in the way we're approaching different kinds of stresses. Just between the two. We noticed that, for example, women, when they're performing language tasks, will use both hemispheres to a very large extent. There will be a lot of communication across the corpus callosum, and they'll be relying upon different areas. Men, for the most part, will use one side of the brain. It's completely different in visuospatial tasks. Men are using both sides of the brain, whereas women are primarily using only one.
So what is this information good for? Like, well, what does this help us do?
Well, it does help. I mean, there's social theory for a long time has struggled to explain differences between men and women and like why they seem to relate to each other in, you know, the ways that I'm sure we're all familiar with. A lot of this is definitely cultural, and you know, there's as culture evolves, hopefully we'll move past those points. But there's definitely areas that are related to physiology and actually to like hormone levels. There's for a long time they thought that sex hormones What, estrogen and the other one, androgens?
Testosterone?
Testosterone, yes. That one. I should know that. that those had basically no effect in the brain. They probably because they couldn't really figure out what that would be. But now they're finding that actually that seems to impact the expression of things like serotonin and a wide variety of effects in the brain. So it seems like we actually have to throw that idea out the window, that the sex hormones are going to have a very large effect on just the way basic brain structures are functioning and the way neurotransmitters are expressed and all kinds of things.
Great.
So, yeah.
All right. Yeah. Well, thanks very much, Mike, for being here today.
You're welcome.
And if anybody out in our radio land wants to have your say on speaking up, do send us an email at feedback@skepticallyspeaking.com with a brief proposal. Not too long, but not too short. Give us a good idea of what you want to talk about, and we'll email you back.
And one thing just to help with the proposals as well would be any related links or research you've done, just diving into the topic a little bit so we can see where your research is coming from.
Awesome. So now let's hear a special message.
Well, feel free to comment on tonight's episode at skepticallyspeaking.com. We'd also love to see you join our Skeptically Speaking Facebook group or have you follow Skeptical Radio on Twitter. Of course, if you want to reach us the old school way, you can email us at feedback@skepticallyspeaking.com.
So next up on Skeptically Speaking is another new segment. We're having so much fun with the new segments.
Fun stuff. Day of spring, so let's just change up everything.
Oh, look, symbolism even. So our next new segment is titled Brownian Motion. And readers of P.Z. Meyer's wonderful blog, Pharyngula, may know Brownian. He's one of their prolific regular commenters. And, of course, here at Skeptically Speaking, we're all Pharyngula fans, and we think Brownian is consistently awesome. So we gave him his own segment. So he'll also be blogging on the website, so do check that out later. Brownian, welcome.
Thanks a lot. How are you doing?
Good. What's new and interesting on the interwebs this week?
Well, first of all, I thought I'd just give a little intro and what I'm going to do. And basically, I love science. It's one of the reasons that I read Pharyngula. Actually, scratch that. I don't love science. I love stuff. I think stuff is fascinating. What I like about science is it's a way of finding out real stuff as opposed to the made-up stuff. So anyways, so part of that, I'm going to talk about random stuff that I happen to find interesting.
Do you want to explain Brownian motion to anybody who doesn't know what that means?
Where Brownian motion came from and where I decided that was going to be my nom de crâne was that Brownian motion, as many chemists and I guess chemists and physicists would know, it describes the random movement of molecules as they bounce around. It also accurately describes how I tend to think. So, and then, of course, what was interesting, I started off writing a blog called Brownian Motion, and then I realized almost everybody in the blogosphere has a blog that references randomness or something. It's just a way of saying that I'm just going to talk about whatever I want. Anyways, so that's where that came from, hence the name of the blog, hence my name, and hence the name of this segment, which I will get to right now. So, first of all, I want to say it's... I want to talk about music, and it was great that you had a skeptical music show last week, so it's I'm coming in a little week late, but I really wanted to bring this up, because I remember reading about this, I think Discover, something like that, about 5-6 years ago, but it's work done by a fellow named Dr. Tim Blackwell and a bunch of collaborators, and what his interest in is in artificial intelligence, collective behavior, and self-organization, and particularly how that can be used to create music. So what he does is he models the behavior of objects, particularly animals that move in collective ways, such as herds of wildebeests, birds, or insects, models particles based on that behavior, assigns them a tone value, and then models them in 3D space. And as they move through that space, depending on where they are, each particle takes on a different quality. Either that might be an increase in pitch if they move along the y-axis, for instance, an increase in volume if they move along the x-axis, and an increase in duration if they move along the z-axis. So what he does is he models all these particles, puts them in three-dimensional space. They're assigned tone values, and then they move. And the way they interact with each other is that based on simple rules. For instance, generally swarms, most individuals in a swarm will try to move towards the center, but they've also got a preservation instinct, so they try not to bump into each other. So that'll be really simply how he'll model that behavior. And then what he does is he records that music, and then plays it. Usually he'll leave it relatively undirected, but he'll bring in other musicians and play that because he also has a fascination with jazz, and he happens to be a jazz musician. And what this music comes out of is this. Okay, to me it's really bizarre. It's this bizarro acid jazz crazy soundtrack to a David Lynch horror movie kind of thing.
Yay!
It is kind of awesome. I totally recommend listening to it if you get a chance. He also experiments with multisensory methods of appreciating music, and he'll use this same sort of information to create textures or visual patterns and then exhibit those in art installations.
So does this have any tangible use? Because it's cool, don't get me wrong. I'm just wondering, is there anything that...
Well, I suppose one of the uses would that, in one sense, I mean, he's talking about emergent properties of self-organization, which does have some implications for AI. What his work actually does or how it might be related, I can't say. But there's something... But, I mean, just from... I mean, essentially, he's adding more information, I guess, about
Absolutely.
What can be done with computers, what can be done by modeling processes like this. And maybe next week I'll look into what might be the ramifications of that and other sort of self-emergent properties.
Wonderful. Next.
Pardon me, I'm getting over a cold, so if I have to pull a Tazonde and breathe away from the mic every so often, I might do that. But so the next thing that I wanted to talk about is something that I got interested in, and in this case, it's an example of citizen science. And because, like I said, I like science and I like stuff, and since I happen to be employed, semi-employed as a scientist, but I also like to do this stuff in my free time. There are a number of ways in which just general people who are interested, particularly now with the pervasiveness of the internet and Web 2.0, can get out and help research. So if anybody's familiar with, I'm sure a lot of the listeners and you guys are familiar with programs like SETI at Home and mm-hmm. Folding at Home. Folding at Home is a program that I use as well. You're familiar with distributed computing, in which users all over the world donate a portion of their machine's processing power to help solve equations or run complex algorithms or something as part of a model, pretty well anything else that requires a lot of brute computational power. This project is a little different. It's called Galaxy Zoo, and it depends on the power of the human brain to do what computers apparently can't yet do very reliably, classify galaxies based on sight and vision alone. So how it works is this. Users sign up and log on and are presented with an image of a galaxy or some other object and then asked to classify the galaxy based on a variety of characteristics, such as is it round or disc-shaped? If it is disc-shaped, does it have a bar? Does it have spiral arms? How many spiral arms are there? And so forth. Now, what's interesting about this is all the images are taken from the Sloan Digital Sky Survey, and they're classified by multiple users so as to reduce errors caused by individual volunteers. And there is a good tutorial on the site, which I didn't read when I first started classifying. So I'm pretty sure like the first 10 or so that I did were completely wrong. But I mean that's the nature of the industry. So, anyways, I'm sure they've got those figured out.
So, but if you're wrong, and then everybody else is wrong,
well, then we're all wrong together.
Well, that seems helpful. All right.
I mean, but statistically, the average...
Statistically, okay.
Yeah, it'll all average out. I mean, then the more volunteers that they get, the more people they can have classifying these individual galaxies, the more likely it is that those errors are going to be reduced.
Right.
One of the things that I find really interesting about this, besides the fact that it's kind of fun to just look at pictures of galaxies while you're doing whatever else, watching TV or anything like that, is the fact that I mean, you're contributing to a program in which they're producing peer-reviewed publications. So, I mean, you're helping, you know, even by doing the grunt work of classifying a few galaxies, looking at a few pictures in your coffee break at work. I mean, you're helping to produce peer-reviewed research and increase our knowledge of the universe and particularly how galaxies form and change and move on.
And you can do it without having to expose yourself to some crazy new experimental medication that turns your skin green or something like
yes,
that.
Yes, very important.
Yes. Is that a normal condition for looking at galaxies?
Not for looking at galaxies, but for contributing to science.
Oh, yeah.
Right, right.
Back in my college days... Little green.
Yeah.
I have to
really?
Pay for school
did
somehow.
Do,
no.
Did you do? Okay. I know. I've actually never met anybody who did those weird get paid for being a test subject, but...
I did. And, he was... I mean, it worked out for him because he was testing those kinds of medications at home, you know, on an amateur basis anyway, so...
So it's all good.
He was getting the good stuff. And a little bit of spending cash.
Was this medication for science or what you might call... Okay. Enough said.
Okay, well, give me one more. And, I believe.
All right, then the other thing, because we'd reference statistics, and statistics happens to be the field that I work in, at least now and pretend to... we live in a world that's increasingly full of statistics, deals with numbers, and those numbers are increasingly used to inform our political decisions and the decisions of policymakers and things like that. One of the problems with this is that it's incredibly hard, or at least has been up until now, for individual members to get their hands on statistical information and to manipulate it. I just recently became aware of a project called Gapminder, which is a free web-based analysis tool produced by some individuals in Sweden, now bought by Google, which is a tool that allows you to graph and compare global data, and particularly demographic and development data over time. So it's preloaded with country-level data that one would plot on a bubble scatter plot, letting one compare three variables over time and across nations. The last time I checked earlier today, it had over 200 variables that could be displayed, including demographic ones, health, environmental, GDP sort of stuff, economic, trade, education, poverty,
so
and development indicators.
No one needs a biostatistician anymore. I can't say that.
Well,
word.
Let's not go that far. The biostatisticians are the ones that are creating some of these data.
Okay, right.
But nobody needs one to interpret these or at least get some sense of what's going on in the world. So if you want to know how life expectancy in Canada has changed over time, you can go and check this out. If you want to compare the under 5 mortality rate of Botswana versus Bolivia, you can do that as well.
Now, can lay people use these really easily?
That's what they're intended to be. They're intended to be a way that... anybody who's relatively computer savvy and at least has a base familiarity with graphs and numbers can use these to gain their own understanding of just the numbers that shape our world and that. So that's exactly what they're aimed at. It's getting lay people to become educated, and that's their stated goal, particularly with Gapminder, is to bring statistics and these important data, which, like I said, inform our political decisions and that, and our policies, but bring them out so everybody can understand them and use them.
It's like our show, but without the numbers. Making everything accessible to lay people.
Well, that's what it's all about in the end.
Perfect. Well, thanks very much, Brownian.
Thank you.
That was wonderful. And we will see him next week. And again... do check the blog. Do I call it a blog still, or is it a website now?
Well, it's a little bit of both. I'm trying to move it more in the website direction, make it a little more functional beyond the blog. But for now, it's pretty much just a port of the old blog with the shiny new polish.
It's shiny. So, yes, do check that, the website. Ish after the show, and Brownian will have some links and such on there.
And now, just before we move on to the next segment, we do want to remind our callers you can reach us live at skepticallyspeaking.com. You can also send us a quick message through Twitter. Just include the word skeptical radio in the subject, and it'll pop up instantly on our screen. So, a great quick way to ask us questions if you don't want to wait in for the phone queue. But let's get started to the main feature for this evening.
Our feature story today is secularism in Alberta. We have Cliff Erasmus on the line, who is the executive director of the Center for Inquiry Alberta. Cliff, are you there?
Cliff,
hey, are you there?
Okay.
There we go.
Hey,
hello. Didn't
hey,
hit the
Dad,
magic
hey,
red
John,
button.
How's it going?
It's going good.
Good.
Thanks for being here, Cliff.
Hey, no problem.
So maybe just tell us a bit about the Center for Inquiry International to begin with.
Transnational, you mean?
Transnational.
Transnational,
right.
Yeah, transnational. It's It literally is transnational. It's all over the world now. There's we have centers in England, and we're actually, there is talk of getting one in the Middle East, believe it or not.
Wow.
Yeah, yeah. It's actually in Lebanon somewhere. I can't remember the name of the city exactly, but there's talk about it. It's pretty amazing. And they opened a center in Beijing right at the beginning of the Olympics last year.
Was the timing chosen for that reason?
Yeah, I think so.
That's brilliant.
I think it was kind of planned that way.
So what does CFI Transnational do then?
Well, it's a secular humanist scientific educational research think tank. There you go.
What does that mean?
What does that mean? Well, it's, we promote secularism, humanism, and the betterment of science education, to improve science education, not just in our own countries like Canada and the United States, but around the world, because science education is taking a pounding in this day and age. It's almost being watered down to a point because the layman, the average person out on the street just doesn't know that much about it. You learn your basics in junior high and high school enough to get you into college, and then, you know, of course, the ones who excel in it usually have a tendency to branch off into a scientific career of some sort.
Mm-hmm.
But even the bare minimum that is being taught now is not enough. We are affiliated with many universities and colleges around the world, and we've spoken with many of the professors in the science departments. And they, are you guys still there? I just heard a click.
Oh, yeah. No,
okay.
No, we're still.
Okay, good. Many of the professors in the science departments are quite discouraged at students that are coming up from high school into the universities and have such a poor knowledge entering the college and university science room. They're nowhere near ready, and it's distressing the professors. Within the post-secondary school system, it's they're quite distressed at it. It's like these students just, they're not even close to being prepared. So for us in Alberta, primarily, that is a goal that we want to change.
Okay, well, let's leave Alberta for one second,
yep.
Because I do want to get to that later specifically.
Yep.
But what kinds of things does CFI get involved in transnationally? Like you sort of mentioned that it was a lobbyist group. So
yep,
what kind of activities?
They do activism and stuff like that, rallying for causes. One of the causes would be gay rights, and that as well, because it's a humanist question, right?
Mm.
So we will lobby and help them with gay pride and so on and so forth. People that are discriminated against, any group that is discriminated against, CFI will take up the cause and whatever lobbying needs to be done. If litigation has to be made, laws need to be changed, whatever, there's the backing of peer-reviewed scientists and so forth, and there's money that CFI has that can be given to these causes, or they can take on the battle themselves because they have the experience.
Well, that's interesting that a sort of science-based or, you know, science-oriented organization would take up these kind of social justice causes.
Well, it's because our principles are based in humanism. It's what it boils down to. Paul Kurtz, the founder of the Center for Inquiry and the founder of the Council for Secular Humanism, which is actually the larger group that CFI is a part of, and that he wrote the Humanist Manifesto and the Humanist Manifesto 2, which came out in the 80s. The second version came out, which had some stuff added to it for basically human violations that happen throughout the world. And the Humanist Manifesto is used as a tool at the United Nations and around the world to bring justice to human rights, to the right that every human being has for existing on this planet.
Mm-hmm.
And because of the concept of humanism, then these causes, even though we are a scientific-based organization, humanism comes into the role because we look at the world in a naturalist manner. We believe that everything that we see around us, the universe, the nature, whatever, can be explained with science and will be explained through science eventually.
So is CFI, you keep mentioning the word humanist, so is CFI an atheist organization?
No, it's not.
Okay, because I think some people think it is.
Oh, most people think it is.
Okay.
No, it's not. Okay. It is not an atheist organization.
No, that sounds good. So what's the difference between humanism and atheism then?
Well, atheism is a standpoint. It's maybe a point of view. Atheist comes from the Greek word atheos, which means without God. And that means all gods, all deities, everything. Atheists go one step further, to quote Richard Dawkins, and I'm probably not going to quote it correctly, but Richard Dawkins says everybody's an atheist. I just go one step further and one more God.
Right.
Which is all gods.
Exactly.
So the Christians and let's say all the Abrahamic religions, the three of them, the three monotheisms, they're atheists when it comes to the fact of Greek mythology. You know, they don't believe in Zeus and Apollo and Aphrodite and all of them, right? They don't believe in them, but they believe in the one God, the Judeo-Christian God.
Agreed.
Whereas an atheist goes one step further, doesn't believe in any of them. And that's all an atheist is. And a lot of people think an atheist is something else. And if you when you boil it down, like for me personally, when I boil it down, I am a person with no belief. And I am an atheist. But first and foremost, I'm a humanist because I believe in the human equation. I believe that humanity can and will, hopefully, solve our problems through the humanist endeavor, which is to treat one another with respect, to care about one another, and to realize that some of these belief systems are dividing us. And you know, a lot of people that claim themselves as an atheist, they'll say, "Well, I'm an atheist. That's it. That's as far as they go." And they don't get involved in anything else, and they very quietly go on with their lives, which is totally cool. You know, most of my friends that are atheists, they're just like, "Why do you get into this stuff?" And I said, "Well, I'm not into it for the atheism. I'm into it for the humanism."
Right.
Well, I know I've just learned a lot about the difference.
Yeah. Atheos. If you look up atheos, A-T-H-E-O-S. And Google it or whatever, it'll come up with a zillion different sites that'll tell you all about it, but it just boils down to without God.
A little bit of extra homework for the listeners, extracurricular activities.
You see, that's our new format, people, homework.
Homework. Yes, you will all be assigned, and it is due by next Thursday at 12 o'clock. While we're kind of finishing a point here, we do have Nathan on the line with a quick question or comment. I'm just going to bring him into the conversation really quickly here. Are you there, Nathan?
Oh, doing fine. I guess this is a new show, so are you looking for new fans?
We are looking for fans, yes.
Gee, well, I'll consider my application submitted.
All right. Have you gone through the formal steps on the website? There's a new form, application process. You will have to send in your CV.
Okay.
Your SIN number.
Oh, gee. And I've got so many SINs. I do have something to ask Cliff, by the way. Great to talk to you again, Cliff.
How's it going?
All right.
Good.
I was talking to a couple of the university students here who are non-believers, and one of them mentioned a little conundrum about whether or not to mention his involvement with the local atheist group on campus because of the possibility of a more religious person seeing that on a resume and discriminating against him based on that. Mm-hmm. Does CFI have any dealings with situations like that?
Great question, Nathan.
You know what? I don't know if there's actually been any discriminatory action against somebody who has possibly done something to an atheist or anything. There's been some weird incidents and stuff. And, yes, CFI would definitely come to the defense of the individual who's being discriminated against. And it doesn't matter if you're an atheist or whatever. Discrimination is something we just absolutely abhor. We do not tolerate it whatsoever. But in the case of an atheist and somebody being discriminated against for a job interview or just simply that you cannot have a job here because you're a non-believer, that is discriminatory. That would fall under the human rights act within this country because it's a discrimination because you cannot discriminate against someone with certain beliefs or lack thereof. So yes, we would take that up. There was an incident down east a few years ago. I'm not going to mention names because I don't do that, but one of the members of the Center for Inquiry down there was actually assaulted. He was putting posters up on campus at U of T for Christopher Hitchens was going to do a talk on his book, God, the Failed Hypothesis, How Religion Poisons Everything. That was Victor Stenger. It was the Victor Stenger talk, God, the Failed Hypothesis, not Christopher Hitchens. I'm sorry about that. Is God, the Failed Hypothesis. And these I believe they were students. Don't quote me on this, but they were walking by and they saw the posters going up and they were absolutely enraged. And the gentleman who was putting the posters up was yelled at. They yelled at him first and said, "You have a smart mouth." And he just responded with, "Well, just leave me alone. You know, I'm not doing anything wrong here. I'm practicing my right to freedom of expression and free speech." And the guy slapped him and then headbutted him in the face and I don't know if broke his nose, but broke the skin open, and he assaulted him. So he went and he pressed, I'm not sure if the charges actually went through. The charges may have gone through as assault, but I believe it was they were trying for almost a hate crime. But nothing became of the hate crime aspect of it. And I think, I think that is a hate crime, me personally. If a person who is stating an opinion that we are allowed to state in this country under the Charter of Rights, and he was assaulted for it. Like, if we assaulted a person of belief because of their belief, you could guarantee we'd end up in the slammer or at least very, very empty in the pocketbook.
Absolutely.
And do not tolerate that, Nathan, whatsoever. CFI will come to the defense immediately.
Nathan, did that answer your question?
Oh, absolutely. And if you don't mind, I just had one other item I wanted to mention. Is that okay?
I'm okay with it, yeah.
If you make it quick.
Yep. The other thing is the plans to put through a law allowing for children or youth who refuse to study biology because of their religious beliefs, they're preventing them from being excluded from courses in university again, mm-hmm. which require such basic concepts.
That's right. And, that is ridiculous. If that's going to happen, and I've heard that that's possibly going to happen in this province, I've heard that in the last few days, I find it appalling. I cannot. What are they going to do? When this student graduates high school, they're just going to give him a passing mark in biology? Like, come on. This kid's going to go to university and be allowed to go into all these other classes with these other students. He was given this passing mark, but he never actually passed the exam. He doesn't know the stuff he needs to know to be in biology in first year university. It's ridiculous. And once again, it's the elitist attitude that the religious right is taking. They have this elitist attitude that they are special. They get special treatment. And you know what? We don't need to teach our kid this biology stuff, but we can still pass him. It's ridiculous. Absolutely ridiculous.
Okay.
Thanks, Nathan.
Well, thank you very much. I'll see you guys later.
Bye. Sounds good. Thanks, Nathan.
Thanks.
Hi. So let's continue on with Alberta. What else is going on? What else is CFI dealing with here? You spoke to me earlier about creationism in public schools, specifically small town of Cochrane.
Oh, yeah, my favorite place.
Do you want to talk a little about that?
Sure. It's interesting because it's a very tangled web. And when you start speaking to trustees and stuff, they skirt around the question, they avoid it, and so on and so forth. And most people know that that's what happens with anybody you speak to in a political position or whatever it is. So in Cochrane itself, Cochrane is a very conservative town. It has quite a large religious population, which is fine. I have no problem with that. The issue that I stumbled upon a few years ago, and this is why the Center for Inquiry, I brought it to Calgary, was to fight this very sort of thing, is there is a school in Cochrane that it's a public school, by the way, so it's publicly funded, and that it's not one of the Catholic schools.
Mm-hmm.
It is a public school. I'm going to make that very clear. And they weren't full to capacity yet with students, so they had extra rooms, possibly part of a wing of one of the schools that was empty. Okay, cool. That's fine. And they're allowing another school to share the space. Okay, that's cool too. But what we found out was it was the Cochrane Christian Academy that was sharing the space. Okay, that's fine. And they were receiving public money. Well, that's not so fine. Because so, here's the situation. When we get census, when they come and census us at our door and they ask us where your taxes go, is to the public school system or to the separate school system, you know, I say the public system. Well, I find out, you know, some years later that it's all baloney. It gets put into a coffer and they divide it up. This past summer, our conservative government here saw fit to not tell the public or anybody else that they were increasing public funding of private schools.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the Christian Academy in Cochrane is considered a private school, which now receives 70% of your tax dollars to teach creationism. I'm sure that just threw you guys off, right?
Well, no, we'll maybe jump back on that point in just a couple moments here. I just wanted to remind the callers quickly again, the number to call in with a question, it's 780-492-2577, extension 1, live at skepticallyspeaking.com or Skeptical Radio on Twitter. And we're actually going to jump into a quick promo for next week's show, and then we'll get right back to you, Cliff.
Okay, no problem.
All right, here we go.
This is Desiree, the host of Skeptically Speaking, Edmonton's only skeptical call-in talk show. Next time, we'll be talking about cults with Dr. Stephen Kent. Dr. Kent has done extensive research on new and alternative religions, such as the Children of God and fundamentalist Mormon polygamy. He's been consulted on legal cases concerning Scientology, Satanism, ritual abuse, and sexual abuse allegations. This is the man who can finally explain to us what drives otherwise rational people to join cults. How does brainwashing work? And what's really the difference between a religion and a cult anyway? Find out on the next Skeptically Speaking. Cliff, you still there?
Yep.
Lovely. We do have a caller, but I just want to go to a different topic for a second.
Yeah.
Because there's been a lot of mainstream media attention about the atheist bus campaign.
Really?
So, yes.
You're kidding.
I heard you did, what, 12 interviews one day or...
Oh, it was ridiculous.
Possibly more than that.
In the last month, I've probably done about 17 or 18 interviews.
Well, give us some background there.
Where do you want me to start? Okay, let's start with how it started. The Atheist Bus Campaign. Basically, the bus campaign states on the sides of buses, there is probably no God.
Mm-hmm.
Now stop worrying and enjoy your life. It's the exact same poster that the Richard Dawkins Foundation started in the United Kingdom back late last year. And it's,
right.
I believe it's still running. Very successful,
mm-hmm.
by the way, in the UK. So the Free Thought Association of Canada thought, let's try it here. So they started it in Ontario with basically just wanting to do it in Toronto only. And what had happened, and this is what was so shocking, it's all donations from the public. So people who were into this donated money to the campaign to pay for these bus ads. There was a large influx of money coming from Calgary. And down east, they're scratching their heads.
Right.
They're telling me. I'm scratching my head going, Calgary? Like, come on, conservative Calgary. And people are donating money. So they thought, okay, let's put Calgary on the map, and let's see if we can get some buses there, too. And as it is right now, Toronto and Calgary are the only two cities. Ottawa looks like they are going to do it now, that are going to run the ads. So Calgary's, we are now into the end of our second week. There's two more weeks to go. For the campaign, it was running 4 weeks, and we're trying to get them into Edmonton, but it's a little tricky. Now, I must make very clear that the Center for Inquiry is not a part of this. Yes, I am the executive chair for the Center for Inquiry, but I myself am representing the Free Thought Association of Canada out here because we don't have a branch out here. And that, so I mean, I'm a member of the Free Thought Association of Canada, but. So I'm basically their mouthpiece out here in Alberta and that. But CFI, because it is at the Atheist Bus campaign, and the website is atheistbus.ca. You can go there and check it out.
Mm-hmm.
Because it is the Atheist Bus campaign, CFI cannot approve it because CFI is not an atheist group.
Right.
Okay, so I'll make that perfectly clear. So anyways, now what has happened is Imam Sowardi, the leader of the Canadian Muslim Congress is in Calgary. He lives in Calgary. He's done a counter campaign to it which states that God loves everybody, even those who don't believe in him, and they will be launched on this coming Monday.
I heard about that.
Yeah.
So, actually, we do have a caller on the line. Yeah. We have a couple of callers.
Yeah, we have a couple in queue here. I'm not sure if we have Ian or Kevin first. I believe we still have Kevin. Are you there, Kevin?
Yeah.
Hi, Kevin. I think you tried to send us an email. We did get it, but I'll let you ask your question right on air here, the way we prefer it anyway.
Yeah, well, not exactly a question, but kind of hearing the guest say that about science education, the elementary, Alberta's new elementary science education curriculum is under review, and there's still a week to put input on it.
Mm-hmm. That's brilliant. And actually, Kevin sent us some links, so we will post them on the site afterwards. So can you, this is an open process?
That's what I believe. I basically heard about it at a meeting last week.
Interesting.
So I don't know all the detail.
We need to really check and make sure that that is an open process, because last year we had, the Center for Inquiry had inquired with Alberta Education if the public actually has any input into any of the curriculum courses, and the one that we specified was the science course, and the minister at the time had stated that absolutely not. The public has no say whatsoever.
Interesting.
Yeah, we'll have to look at that and
so check into that, and please let me know, because and I'll get my education guy down here to check into it too, because
awesome.
That's fascinating.
Thanks very much,
sure.
Kevin.
Thank
we
you,
appreciate
Kevin.
That.
That's great.
All right, we'll just get the other caller queued up here.
Okay,
take a couple moments.
So, getting back to the atheist bus campaign.
Yeah.
So, what has so you told us about what the other what churches think, but what's media been like about this?
The media's been all over it, like a like a rabid dog.
Right. Is it positive or negative, though? Do you feel?
I think it's been very positive. To
Wonderful.
Be honest with you, there's maybe been the odd little negative thing, but I find most journalists, they're very professional, they're very impartial, which they have to be. Very fascinated, though. Like the questions I've been getting them is like, okay, you guys are atheists, you know, like, don't you just kind of, like, not say anything? And I said, well, yeah, usually, but, you know, we're kind of following Richard Dawkins' lead finally that it's time for us to say something. It is our turn to say something, and it is our turn to practice our rights of freedom of speech and freedom of expression.
It's often compared to coming out of the closet for atheism.
Exactly. That's exactly what we're going through. There's a cartoon that a friend of mine did where he drawn these two closets, and one closet has gay above it, and it's blown wide open, and there's a lonely hanger swinging in there. And then there's the other closet that has atheist over it, and you can see these two little beady eyes peeking through the door. And it's very much like that. So the bus campaign is being used to not so much to create a dialogue, and unfortunately, it has created a lot of emotion within the religious group and a lot of animosity. But what we wanted to say, most importantly, that it's A-okay in this day and age and in the 21st century to stand up and say, you know what, I'm not a believer. And it's A-okay to do that. And it's not maybe, well, maybe it is to rally the troops a little bit.
Cliff, I'm just going to jump in with a question here. Actually, I think it might be related. I believe we have Ian on the line here.
Mm-hmm.
Just going to bring him on. Are you there, Ian?
Hello.
Hi.
How's it going, Cliff?
Oh, hey, Ian. How's it going? Good.
Not too bad. I was going to say, we actually got a bunch of those bus ads printed onto 11 by 17 posters, and we just put about 40 of them up around campus today.
Awesome.
And I think we're going to extend to White Ave in the short term.
Good job.
A little bit cheaper than the full bus ad, and it's just kind of a start, but
hey, that's a great way to go. And you know what, if you guys can, if you got somebody up there with a really decent camera, get some pictures of them where you guys are putting them, and then we can get them up on CFI's website. Now, even though CFI is not an atheist organization, we are a humanist organization, and we absolutely will promote freedom of speech, and that's exactly what this is.
And an endorsement of just getting out there and putting your message there.
And supporting the Free Thought Association of Canada.
Now, Ian, I heard that you were involved in something else. You rejected your iron ring?
Yeah, so...
Hey, I didn't hear that. That's cool. Okay.
Can you tell us about that really, really quickly?
Okay, so basically, all graduating engineers are offered this iron ring, and it's kind of a Masonic secretive kind of ceremony where you honor your commitments to uphold the societal good and all that kind of stuff. But it's based on a lot of old traditional language. So in the obligation they have you sign, they end it with God helping me, I'll keep these things upon honor and cold iron or something like that. And so I asked the wardens who were doing the ring sizings and the signings if I could strike God helping me from it, and then I could sign it honestly and actually honorably, since it talked a lot about honor. But they said, no, we've talked about it before, and we won't change this language, so we're just going to leave it, and you can sign it or not. It's not necessary to be an engineer, but kind of everyone does. So I said, well, I'm not signing it on my principles.
Wow.
And you wrote a letter, and just stating your objections, and it was quite an eloquent letter.
I made this personal letter to the Faculty of Engineering in APEGA and the Council of Seven Wardens who oversee the Iron Ring process, and I forwarded this to those organizations and to the media as well. And I did a journal interview earlier today, which should run probably tomorrow. And basically, I outlined my objections to signing a document that called for my honor and higher, all that kind of, you know, good stuff, but then it violates part of my own principles.
Oh, perfect. Thank you so much for calling in, Ian. We're definitely going to post the link after the show.
All right, thank you.
All right. Have a good night. We have another caller, I believe.
Yeah, we're going to just push the buttons really quickly here and get them on.
All right.
All right, they should be there now. I believe it's David on the line.
Hello?
Oh, hello. I just want to say thank you very kindly for having me on. It was a question for the fella that you just had on. With the humanism thing, I have no side on the issue. I think faith has many forms, but with the humanism thing, I was just wondering about the, I heard nothing about family, and I thought that that was kind of important, and I just didn't hear anything about family, and I just thought mostly in most faith-based organizations or even churches or whatever, they always usually talk about family. You know, maybe humanism has something to do with family. I'm not too sure.
Oh, interesting. You're sort of talking about a sense of community as well, or are you talking about like a physical family?
Oh, a physical family. Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
Right.
So I think just how humanism relates to maybe how you should approach your family life is the question.
Is that right? Is that how he's posing it?
Well, what I was saying, what I'm asking you is, mm-hmm. I never heard anything about that family. Now, that particular type, sure, I guess you could answer it with that. I'm sure I was a little vague about that.
It's okay.
All right, well, we'll get Cliff to quickly answer that one off air. The minutes are running low here, so I'll just...
Fair enough.
Okay,
fair enough.
Thank you very much.
But he'll answer.
Bye-bye.
Thanks very much, caller.
Bye. Bye-bye.
Cliff, what do you think?
Humanism has been accused of many, many things. It's been accused of being very selfish, self-centered and stuff. And, you know, in a way, I think in the past it really kind of was.
Really?
It is sad. And that... I see it as a family endeavor because I was a Christian up until I was 15 years old, and very much a sense of community within my church and that, and my family, of course, were all Christians and stuff, and we all did everything together in that. I have a family, and we live our life through the humanist principles and that, and we go to parties and that with other humanists and stuff, and it's all very much family-oriented. And that, we teach our children the humanist principles, and a sense of community is there, and it is starting. There never really was a community for humanists and stuff. And that's what CFI is trying to do, is create a community of people, of like-minded people, very similar to what churches have. It's really not that different. And we do have, camps, called skeptic camps and stuff like that for children to go to, just like the Jesus camps, I guess you could call them, and that. But there are camps for kids and that, where they learn science and just how to treat one another with the humanist principles and so on and so forth. But humanism, for me, myself personally, is very much a family-oriented thing. And it's very important that our children learn that with the humanist principles that we can care about everybody without having to discriminate against their belief. Beliefs do not come into it. It's you care about this person for the simple fact that they are a human being. They're a living human being. The one thing that we all share is that we are humans. We may not share the same belief system, but we are humans, and we are a community, one family, and that's the human race.
Lovely. Well, that's all the time we have for tonight.
That went fast.
Yeah, I think we have about three quarters of our list we didn't even scratch.
Yeah, no, I have so many more questions for you, Cliff. We're going to have part two.
Part two? No problem.
Perfect. So, again, thanks so much to Cliff Erasmus from the Center for Inquiry Alberta for being with us. And thanks to Sean for being an awesome producer.
My pleasure, as always.
We hope everyone enjoyed the new format, and we'll be back again next week with more Skeptically Speaking.
Thanks, and we definitely would appreciate some feedback on the format.
Absolutely.
And how you're enjoying things so far. So please get back to us on the blog or just feedback at skepticallyspeaking.com.
Have a good night, everyone.
Thanks, guys. Bye.
Bye. And that wonderful song is coming up, the one that was played live here last week.
Oh, we got the pre-recorded version. I think I'll mix it up week to week.
And again, that's The Burning Hell. America, everything you believe is a lie.
Good night, everyone.
The moon is painted on the sky. Things sometimes fall up, but you never see. And everything you believe is a lie.
Dinosaurs were invented by God as a test. Our bodies don't rot when we die. All the hippies are working.